This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Everything is safe.
Nuclear facilities in the United States hovered on the brink of catastrophe in the last month of June 2011, and it was due to climate change. Nuclear reactors and labs depend upon a relatively stable climate. A single accident could permanently withdraw a large area of the United States from safe human use, and the same is true in Europe or anywhere around the world. Nuclear technology, instead of being a solution to climate change, is becoming a victim of it, and we're going to tell you about that today. The nuclear power plant at Fort Calhoun, Nebraska, was within feet of a 100% chance of meltdown, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The Cooper Nuclear Station, also on the Missouri River in Nebraska, was also surrounded by flood waters. In the very same week, a wall of fire raged towards the Los Alamos National Weapons Lab, the nuclear testing facility hosting many thousands of barrels of plutonium waste, old dumps, and the most dangerous nuclear materials on the planet. A chorus of authorities said over and over, repeated like a mantra in every news report, that everything was completely safe. Just like the government did in Japan before and even after four nuclear reactors blew up and three of them melted down. It's always declared safe until it isn't. And even then, they don't tell you. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Later in the program, you will hear something completely different from every political promise and every business plan you've ever heard. Scientists, peak oil specialists, environmentalists, and a new breed of financial realists all say the same thing. The age of economic growth is over. We need to shrink our economies. They call it degrowth. You will hear two specialists from a recent degrowth conference in Vancouver, Canada, what your mainstream media won't tell you. But first we go to the nuclear threats hanging over America. Why there will be more events, perhaps a meltdown and a spread of radiation due to climate change. You will also hear who owns America's second largest nuclear company, the corporation behind the disputed Vermont Yankee reactor, the Indian Point plant hanging over New York City, and the operator of the now flooded Fort Calhoun reactor in Nebraska. No, it's not Mr. Burns. Then we'll go to Los Alamos, the belly of the nuclear weapons beast. Despite what you think, it wouldn't be a good thing if that burned down, unless you want a side order of plutonium with your lunch. Fort Calhoun hasn't been a military fort since 1827. Now it's a village of 856 people on the eastern side of Nebraska, more or less in the center of North America. The Fort Calhoun nuclear generating station is located nearby, right on the Missouri River, which snakes through the U.S. Midwest for 2,300 miles, or 3,700 kilometers, until it dumps into the Mississippi River, just north of the major city of St. Louis. There is a lot downstream from this reactor site, right down to New Orleans and the Gulf of Mexico, should the deadly radioactivity get washed away in a flood. The reactor is one of the smallest in America at Fort Calhoun. It's under 500 megawatts. It's the old GE Mark I design, a clone of the reactors that blew up in Japan after only a few hours without electrical power. In late June 2011, record snowfalls in the Rocky Mountains, combined with extreme rainfall events, to raise the Missouri River to dangerous levels. Both the deep snowfall and the extreme rain can be attributed to climate change. Burning fossil fuels has warmed the world enough to change the amount of water in the atmosphere, raising it by 4% since 1970, according to the IPCC, and confirmed by several top American scientists, including Dr. Kevin Trenberth. It's not something you can argue about. You can measure it. There it is. This year, the runoff was so strong, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had to open up every available floodgate on six flood control dams upstream of the Calhoun nuclear plant. Two of the dams are built out of earth only. If just one dam breaks, the whole lot could go. If just one dam breaks, the Calhoun nuclear plant would almost undoubtedly flood and could have parts of the plant washed away in an inland tsunami. The chair of the NRC, Gregory Jasko, did not mention this risk when he visited Fort Calhoun on June 27th. The operators, a big company called Entergy, don't talk about it, declaring there's no risk of any radiation release or meltdown. The final owner of the plant is the state of Nebraska through the Omaha Public Power District, the OPPD. The flooding of the nuclear plant, the extreme stress on the upstream dams, is expected to continue until early August. This is an ongoing risk, even if the peak water appears to have passed away, so don't let this news item just fall out of your attention span. At the time of this broadcast, A water-filled berm called an aquadam was punctured by a plant worker and collapsed. The aquadam was promoted as the main line of defense for the reactor buildings until it failed. Then officials dismissed it as unnecessary. The fallback plan was apparently just sandbags at the doors. We might expect the National Guard would have flown in heavy sandbags in a hurry. That didn't happen. In fact, the whole response has been very much smaller than the risk warrants. The surrounding water leaked into one of the main electrical transformers. Standby generators had to be fired up to cool the fuel inside, even though the plant had been shut down for maintenance. The spent fuel pool, which is loaded, also has to be cooled, as we learned from the radiation pouring out of the spent fuel pool at Fukushima Daiichi Reactor No. 4. That one was also closed down for refueling when the tsunami hit. They still need to be cooled. Power was restored at Fort Calhoun. All the power lines are running through what looks like a slow-moving lake. It is the Missouri River eating away at everything. I don't know how confident we can be in those lines. When the water started to pour into the turbine building, again officials said that was nothing unexpected.
Water leaking into the turbine building of the Fort Calhoun nuclear power plant in Nebraska today was expected and did not pose a safety risk, according to NBC News.
We know from Fukushima that nuclear power plants are riddled with basements, trenches, and pipes carrying wires. Is the wiring in the turbine building designed to be underwater? Can they keep the electrical system and the cooling pumps going? Has water started leaking through all those connections into the main reactor building? None of that information is coming out. It's all safe. It's all safe.
The plant is safe, will continue to be safe, and will continue to do the things necessary to keep it in a safe condition.
And who could have predicted any of this? Was it a secret that the mountains were buried under record snow? Does the Nuclear Regulatory Commission not know climate change means more extreme rainfall events? At least the NRC did slightly improve the flood chances at the Fort Calhoun plant last year, in one of their rare attempts to get companies to follow safety rules. Otherwise, NRC documents show, there was a 100% chance of reactor core damage if the water reached 110 feet above sea level, and that could still happen if a dam bursts. According to Dave Lockbaum, one of the few nuclear engineers we can trust, the NRC inspected the Fort Calhoun plant and gave it a yellow safety flag for flood protection problems. Yellow is the second most serious, with only two given by the NRC in 2010 for the whole country. The operators, Entergy, and we'll hear more about them soon, contested the NRC findings and tried to avoid upgrading their flood protection. The NRC won that small battle, which may have saved the plant. Was the NRC asking for a 50-foot wall to surround the facility to protect it permanently? Surely that is needed. It's wide open prairies. Why don't they build something? No, Entergy was protesting building a few small berms, getting their staff to practice what to do in a flood and other minor adjustments. It wasn't nearly enough. The electric transformers in the turbine building have already flooded. Perhaps more, but we haven't been told about it. None of this is a surprise. Floods in 1993 endangered the Fort Calhoun plant. The state government, the federal regulators, the operators, had 18 years to plan out the response for the next big one and opted for quarterly profits instead. The operator, a company called Entergy, is famous for regular quarterly profits. Entergy is the second largest nuclear operator and owner in the United States behind Exelon. They operate the old Vermont Yankee reactor in New England. Entergy promised the state they would not continue past 2012 without permission of a state board, but applied for and got another 20-year license from the NRC, who never denies a license application, as we know, even after the Vermont Senate voted against continuing the plant operation. Entergy is suing the state to keep the old reactor going despite huge public opposition in Vermont. New York City residents have lots to fear from Entergy's operations of a reactor at Indian Point, just 35 miles north of the megacity. Believe it or not, the plant, too, is near a seismic zone. It has a string of safety problems and leaks.
Radio EcoShock.
Now we find Entergy at Fort Calhoun with Mickey Mouse safety preparations for the big flood, which was predictable months or years ago. The New York Times reports a line of staff hand-passing orange fuel cans on catwalks over the floodwaters, trying to keep dozens of small pump engines going, trying to keep up with the leaks all over the facility. It's frantic, and it's not what we were told about safety in the nuclear industry. Who is the operator, Entergy? Their board of directors is a snapshot of the American nuclear industry today. Most outstanding to me is the number of former high-level government officials and elected politicians who end up as highly paid directors in a nuclear company. like Ms. Alex M. Herman, an Entergy director since 2003. She's also a director of Coca-Cola, Cummins, the Engine People, and MGM Mirage, the entertainment and gambling giant. Ms. Herman was the U.S. Secretary of Labor from 1997 to 2001. She was also a White House assistant to the U.S. President. She got $136,000 as an Entergy director in 2010. Or how about this for political power for your board? Entergy is a southern-based company. They have banking connections in Ohio, but really they're from the south. In January 2011, they scored another big politician, Blanche Lambert Lincoln. She was a congresswoman for Arkansas and then a U.S. senator for the state of Arkansas right up until 2011 when she went on to the Entergy board. Blanche Lincoln was in a position to oversee some parts of the nuclear industry in her position as a member of the U.S. Senate Committee on Finance, Energy, and Natural Resources. Now she'll get another $120,000-something dollars or more from the big nuclear company as a director, straight from the Senate floor to the industry boardroom. W.J. Billy Towson is on the board with her. Billy was a United States representative for the state of Louisiana until 2005. He served as chairman of the U.S. House Committee on Energy and Commerce. You can't get more plugged in than that. That's the revolving door of nuclear politics. Candidates get campaign money while they serve, and then a directorship, often just a few meetings a year when they leave. Entergy has a mixed record on the environment. The current chairman of the board of directors of Entergy is J. Wayne Leonard. He helped arrange a joint venture with the infamous climate deniers, the Koch brothers. Entergy Koch LP, a gas and commodities trading company, was sold to Merrill Lynch, though, in 2004. Leonard is also connected to the oil industry. He is a director of Tidewater Inc. That company prides itself on providing services to the offshore oil industry, including, quote, "We're serving customers who are operating in more remote, deeper, and increasingly hostile environments in order to meet the world's energy demands," end quote. They serve the most risky plays for oil and gas. On the other hand, J. Wayne Leonard took the Entergy Board of Directors into endorsing cap and trade as a way to control climate change emissions. The nuclear industry saw climate change as a way to become the good guys, since their reactors, once they're built, hardly emitted carbon. There may even be a future for new reactors, they thought, which would be good for the construction company directors on Entergy's board. The rare big industry support for cap and trade, and their admission that global warming was happening, more or less collapsed with the failure of the climate legislation in the United States. But at least they tried. For all the power on this Entergy board, none of them are owners of the company. In fact, company insiders own less than 1% of the stock. So who is Mr. Burns behind it all? It could be you, via the big Wall Street institutional holders, who hold up billions of dollars worth of shares. Here is a short list of the biggest Entergy owners. The two biggest are Franklin Resources and Price T. Rowe Associates, with $750 million worth each. State Street Corp. and Evercore Trust Company come in at $500 million. Then some names you know, like Barclays, BlackRock, Goldman Sachs, Lazard, Bank of New York Mellon, and many more. These are the institutions who fund risky nuclear power. They could lose big one day if even one reactor is permanently shut down or blows up like Fukushima. They make big money every quarter, though, partly by fighting off costs imposed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or by relicensing against the will of the states and the local populations, keeping old reactors going. That's very profitable. Your pension fund may have bought into nuclear power. Find out. Get out. Because nuclear power is set for dying after Fukushima, and now these near misses in the United States. We hope they are near misses. The drama is not over yet.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
So let's switch to the Los Alamos Lab. The Los Alamos National Laboratory is the site of many black nuclear doings. The bombs dropped on Japan were made there. A lot of earlier nuclear testing at Los Alamos put strontium-90 into the bones of a generation in the 50s and 60s. There are old dumps on the site, some of them badly marked. I doubt anyone really knows where all the nuclear materials are. They say they do, but I don't think they do. We do know, through the Christian Science Monitor and the group Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety, there are between 20 and 30,000 barrels of nuclear waste sitting in flammable tents above the ground at the Los Alamos site, and these barrels contain plutonium. A raging fire was 3.5 miles, that is 5.6 kilometers, away. The whole lab was forced to close and turn off the gas lines with the fire clearly visible. 15,000 people work there, mostly on nuclear weapons technology. A spot fire appeared on the lab property but was put out. That was at Tech Area 49, where underground tests with radioactive materials were undertaken in the early 1960s. Who knows what went up in that smoke? All around, 44,000 acres, 176 kilometers of forest and brush burned violently. Despite all that, what we get from the government officials at the lab is that everything is completely safe from fire. They can't say anything more when we ask because the whole site is a national security secret. The nuclear materials at Los Alamos Lab have the potential to poison the entire U.S. Southwest and perhaps the Northern Hemisphere. The risk of fire was entirely predictable. There was a serious fire in the year 2000, the Cerro Grande fire. Burned another 48,000 acres, destroying some Los Alamos lab buildings that time. According to the Christian Science Monitor, increased radiation levels were measured after that fire, including plutonium, cesium, and strontium. A lab employee who did the research claimed the source was natural radon from the forest, augmented by fallout still present from the nuclear testing years. But can we trust this source, or was radiation released by the fire in 2000 when the lab buildings went up in smoke? It's all a big secret. We don't know then, and we won't be told now, even though the public could be exposed to increased numbers of cancers down the road. Just like the wildfires in the Russian heat wave in 2010, a fire there wiped out power lines to a secret nuclear facility. Russian troops were called in an emergency to fight the flames before they could sweep over whatever nuclear horrors were stored there. A radioactive fire plume was narrowly averted. All around the world, climate disruption has made the use and storage of nuclear materials impossibly dangerous. It's a spin-off of climate change that was predictable, and still we didn't see it, until these three threats now in the United States. Record flooding in Nebraska with two reactors surrounded by running river waters, and drought-driven fire nipping at the edges of vast quantities of the most deadly nuclear elements in a weapons lab. Toss in the rising seas for reactors at Oceanside, and the picture of an industry past its due date becomes complete. The nuclear industry cannot survive the great warming already in process. I'm Alex Smith. Find all our reports at our website, ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for caring about your world.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Many of you have asked for an update on Fukushima and the nuclear disaster in Japan. After all, three out-of-control reactors continue to melt down there. It is difficult to communicate the big picture of that Japanese nuclear accident, or the strange collusion of the American government. They play down the severity of the explosions and the radiation. Here is a discussion, Plato style.
This is Kate Smith.
And I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
We're here to bring you critical information on the triple meltdown of nuclear reactors in Fukushima, Japan.
And questions about the failure of the American government to protect its own citizens from radiation. Why did the Nuclear Regulatory Commission fail to warn Americans about the surge of radiation in early March of 2011?
Why did the government announce it was withdrawing radiation monitors from the West Coast?
Why did the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announce the U.S. would support sales from Japan despite popular concerns about radiation? Is it possible America is downplaying the world's most serious nuclear accident to avoid its own economic collapse? Details to come.
Alex, where do we start?
Everyone needs to recognize the Japanese authorities and the plant owner TEPCO are not trying to stop radiation into the sea and sky yet. They're not engaged in cleaning up the reactors. Their official announcements make clear their first priority is to cope with tons of highly radioactive water already poured over the melting reactor fuel. The contaminated water threatens to flood the site and leak even more into the groundwater and the ocean. The operator has brought in two devices designed to remove enough radioactivity to cycle the water back into the ruins of the reactor to cool the lava-like melted cores. The machines, though, they became quickly clogged with such large amounts of radioactive particles they had to be shut down after very short runs. These filter devices cannot keep up with the cooling needs, much less deal with 110,000 tons of radioactive water hovering near overflow levels in several locations around the site. Officials admit highly radioactive water has reached the water table and it's still flowing into the sea around Fukushima. Samples taken at the end of June from the ocean bottom, 3 kilometers from the reactor site, show strontium-90, a radioactive metal known to lodge in bones and to cause leukemia. Plutonium has also been found on the sea floor. The operator TEPCO is overwhelmed with radioactive water. It is falling behind every announced timetable to cope with it.
On June 23rd, Bloomberg News reported TEPCO is running out of nuclear workers. 3,500 workers have been exposed to radiation at Fukushima Daiichi. Staff on site has dropped from a high of about 2,000 to just over 1,000 people. Banri Kaida, the Japanese Minister of Economy, Trade and Industry, verbally approved a new plan to use senior citizens as volunteers to help the emergency workers at Fukushima. Workers as old as 72 say they have formed a volunteer brigade to go into the reactors to help fix gauges and clean up radioactive debris. In the summer heat, with heavy breathing masks and protective clothing, nobody is certain these seniors can cope with the work. Radiation in some places at Fukushima Daiichi is deadly with just half an hour exposure, but the volunteers deny this is a kamikaze mission.
Yes, and that is exactly what the famous Japanese-American physicist Michio Kaku has been saying for months in the mainstream media and on Democracy Now! Kaku predicted TEPCO would run out of workers. In early April, he called for the deployment of Japanese troops to Fukushima Daiichi. The model is what the Soviet Union did when the Chernobyl nuclear plant blew up in April of 1986. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers were sent in, some for as little as 15 minutes each, to shovel, install pipes, pour a little concrete. Then each man or woman was withdrawn, given a medal, and sent back to the barracks so the next person could step up. This was the only way to work in such a highly radioactive environment in the huge task of burying the reactor in concrete.
What's the financial impact of the Fukushima meltdown?
The total cost of this accident is not entirely known. Nuclear industry executive Arne Gundersen suggests the direct liability to the Japanese government might reach $250 billion. That doesn't count the damage to Japanese trade from countries who suspect radioactive products. It doesn't count downtime to big companies like electronics and car makers who must run part-time shifts of production due to lack of power. The loss of part of Japan to radiation lasting hundreds of years is incalculable. Even the direct costs could bankrupt the Japanese government.
The Japanese are already the most indebted country in the world in relation to their gross domestic product. The government owes at least 200% of the GDP. They have run giant deficits for years, making countries like Greece look prudent and conservative by comparison. How can they afford new billions for compensation, buying liquefied gas from abroad, the loss of the tax base, while still supporting citizens made homeless by the earthquake and the tsunami?
The government cannot afford it, unless they withdraw money from their huge bank account in the United States. Japan is the world's second largest holder of U.S. debt, mostly U.S. treasuries. Japan has over $700 billion banked in America, but if they withdraw that, selling their holdings, the collapse in the value of U.S. treasuries could plunge America into bankruptcy.
America's already close to bankruptcy. The debt limit was reached by June. Congress fought over whether to allow more borrowing or slash government services. In the last big debt sale, the U.S. government-supported agency, the Federal Reserve, bought most of the debt offered. It was called quantitative easing. How is that affected by the nuclear accident in Japan?
To explain the connection, we have to look at a buried story. Nobody wants to talk about Tokyo. Tokyo is the capital of Japan and likely the world's largest city, with somewhere around 35 million people. It is only 140 miles or 225 kilometers south of the Fukushima accident site. In March, after the explosions at all four Fukushima Daiichi reactors, clouds of radioactivity fell on Tokyo. The drinking water was declared unsafe. There was a run on bottled water. The government delivered water to pregnant women and daycare centers. Then the government and the tightly controlled Japanese press went silent about the radiation in Tokyo. Until late April. Then the story came out that most Tokyo sewage plants were overwhelmed with radioactivity. These sewage treatment centers were burning the sludge, further distributing more radioactive particles, which are not destroyed by incineration. Hot ash went out over parts of Tokyo again. The government set up a few radioactive testing sensors in Tokyo. They were 18 meters high, almost 60 feet above the ground. The authorities said radiation levels were very low. Citizens and people from the university began to test radiation at ground level. They found many radioactive hotspots all around Tokyo. They were using cheap handheld Geiger counters. The truth got out over the internet by YouTube videos showing high readings. That forced the government to admit background radiation in Tokyo was 3 times the previous level. It won't go down. These elements last for decades, even centuries. More radioactivity continues to arrive from the Fukushima site itself, especially now that the winds have shifted, blowing south from the plant toward the capital. The Russian media quoted a government inside source saying the Japanese had a plan to move the government from Tokyo to somewhere less radioactive, like Osaka. The government denies this. Major financial newspapers in the United States said national embassies and even the headquarters of some multinational companies were moving out of Tokyo, some to Osaka.
Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to a dialogue on the Japanese nuclear accident and the American response. I'm Kate Smith with Radio EcoShock host Alex Smith. Alex, how does radioactivity in the capital Tokyo tie in with finance?
We need to understand the current financial position of Japan. Not only is the Japanese government holding world record debt, the big banks in the country actually became insolvent in the early 1990s when the property bubble collapsed. It was the same process now going on in America. The banks gave out giant real estate loans with a lot of collateral based on the alleged value of Tokyo property. When the Tokyo real estate dropped sharply in the early 1990s, banks pretended to be solvent by keeping the previous high values on their books. The biggest American banks are doing the same thing right now. So the Japanese banks managed to keep on going for 2 decades, known as zombie banks, because they were actually dead in financial reality. They could continue this pretense by saying, well, the value of Tokyo real estate might go up again, and then our books would be more balanced. Now, with this radiation, everybody knows Tokyo real estate is never coming back to its record high levels. It may even decline, as some people move out due to nuclear concerns. This Fukushima radiation could reveal the true bankrupt state of both the banks and the Japanese government.
So that's Japan. But does all this affect Americans?
Yes. If the Japanese decided to withdraw their billions, America could also go bankrupt, some say. The Obama government realized the risk soon after the accident, I think. On April 17th, Hillary Clinton went to Japan, making public appearances to show American support for the Japanese. Meetings of officials of both countries went on behind the scenes. On April 29th, Foreign Minister Takayuki Matsumoto said the U.S. agreed to help Japan dispel rumors about radioactivity and fight import bans based on safety. The announcement surprised Americans concerned about possible radioactive food and other products from Japan.
So Japan admitted the radiation going into the ocean from Fukushima was triple the amounts announced earlier. The government confirmed the ocean was poisoned with radioactivity along the coastline for 300 kilometers. That's about 186 miles. From onboard their ship, the Rainbow Warrior, Greenpeace found radioactivity in seaweed 12 miles out to sea. It seems incredible the U.S. government would agree to not test seafood products from Japan.
Well, the Obama administration did some very strange things, some of them questionable for the safety of their citizens. The EPA loudly and publicly announced they were withdrawing radiation testing stations from the American West Coast, even though 3 reactors continue to melt down across the Pacific with unknown results. More explosions and releases are possible. In mid-April, FDA spokeswoman Siobhan Delancey announced the agency would not test North Pacific caught seafood for safety. There is no sampling or monitoring for radioactivity from Fukushima bioaccumulating in fish. According to Kyoto, June 26th, the Japanese are now proposing to ship unsold seafood to developing nations. Despite the clouds of radioactivity that continue to blow over much of Japan, the U.S. military has not announced any base closings there either. In mid-March, the military did withdraw thousands of dependents in a mass air operation. But the soldiers and the Air Force are still there. Why is America risking the health of 47,000 troops in Japan? Soon after the accident, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission was warned the only possible outcome after cooling stopped was 3 meltdowns. Why didn't the government warn the American public about the radiation that fell over the whole country about a week later? Kate, my question is, to prevent a run on U.S. treasuries, to stop the Japanese from endangering the economy by withdrawing billions of dollars, did the Obama administration make big concessions to the Japanese?
You're listening to a special update on the Japanese nuclear accident and the American response. I'm Kate Smith with Alex Smith from Radio EcoShock. I think we need to hear more about the local situation in Japan. There are still some 290,000 people in Fukushima City, 37 miles or 60 kilometers away from the plant. Fukushima City was highly irradiated by explosions at the reactors. Like Tokyo, their sewage systems and waterways are also radioactive. Even schoolyards and public parks have hot zones. The municipal government ordered a limit of 1 hour only in the parks. On June 6th, they lifted those restrictions. On June 7th, Greenpeace technicians found a pile of leaves in a park, measuring 4.2 microsieverts per hour. Even the leaves qualified as radioactive waste that needed special handling for 30 years. The leaves cannot be burned. This would just spread the radiation further. Radiation is everywhere. Fukushima City and many other towns and cities in that region are now the world's biggest experiment in living within a radioactive zone. There's nowhere to evacuate all the people.
That's true. The Japanese government tried to raise the permissible levels for radiation of children to 20 millisieverts, the same level previously set for workers inside a nuclear plant. Parents made a rare protest. The government pulled back to 1 millisievert. Now they are issuing bracelets to 34,000 school children to measure radioactivity. As you said, Kate, it's a big experiment, a whole population living in a nuclear disaster zone in Japan.
I'm Kate Smith.
And I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Our profits will continue to grow. We will have more for you. Our economy will continue to grow. More jobs, more jobs. Every politician promises you one big thing, growth, even if it kills the ecosphere. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Are you ready to get smaller? We drill for energy in more dangerous places. We boil tarry oil out of the sand. Some metals get rare. We got to get the oil reserves out of the ground while ecosystems falter. The resource game can't keep up as another billion people want cars, computers, big homes, meat diets. New consumers just like us, all depending on fossil fuels, are all over the world. A growing voice of scientists and economists say it just can't last. They are the heretics who say the economy must shrink. It is called degrowth. A smaller GDP could be a good thing. Should we wait for the oil to run out, food to run out, for collapse? Or can we plan our way back down through power down, simplification, and localization? You are about to hear two speakers from the opening panel at the latest degrowth conference on June 3, 2011, in Vancouver, Canada. From the fore, Dr. Bill Reese, the inventor of the ecological footprint concept, and Conrad Schmidt, author and filmmaker, founder of the Workless Party. Both of these men are annoying. Professor Bill Reese listens and looks at all the schemes offered as solutions. Then he measures the actual results. Sometimes that isn't so pleasing, especially when we had such good intentions. Conrad Schmidt can look a paradox in the eye. Does a hybrid car really save any energy? Is cheaper alternative energy really good for the planet? Rude questions indeed. Here we go from a compilation of recordings from that Degrowth Vancouver panel, starting with Conrad Schmidt.
Yeah, it's been quite a bit of a hectic day, because I've been helping organize this conference, and it's really exciting to see this event finally happen. And so I know a lot of people have heard me with this story before, but I love telling it anyway, and I like to talk a little bit about something called the Jevons Paradox. It's probably the single most important concept in understanding the requirements of ecological sustainability. Really confusing. Simple to solve, but confusing. Here's a quick question. Which one of these is better for the environment? A bicycle, sounds a little crazy, or an SUV? Well, the answer is it depends. Here's the story. There was this time I used to have this job, and I used to head off to work, and I used to drive in my SUV off to work. And I was feeling guilty. And I said, you know what, I want to reduce my ecological footprint. What I'm going to do is I'm going to get rid of that SUV. I'm going to ride a bike. And I did. I got rid of that SUV, and I started taking public transportation, riding my bike, and it was great. I was getting healthy. Life was good. But here's where the Jevons paradox comes into play. It was at the end of the month. I got this big, happy surprise. My paycheck. There was 25% more money. I was saving money. Oh, this is great. I'm going to buy a camera. No, I'm going to go to France. I'm going to fly in an airplane, maybe a vacation, bigger home. You see, there's the conundrum. Once that money re-enters in the economy, that efficiency benefit simply results in increased growth. Let me give you a few more examples. Often we think of, well, that we can become more efficient and reduce our ecological footprint. But if you look back, coal was 50% more energy efficient than wood and produced, and you didn't have to chop down forests. Petroleum was 50% more efficient than coal and less sulfur and mercury. Each green technology, each of those could be, on our definition of green, could have been regarded as a green technology over its predecessor. That's the Jevons paradox, you see. Any efficiency that inserted into the economy puts a mandate that either we increase and consume more or we face rising unemployment. The solution is simple, really simple, even though it might sound confusing. So the way I personally solved it was to say, what was I going to do with that extra money? Well, I walked into my boss's office and I said, how about I don't show up here on a Friday and you don't pay me? He thought about it for 10 seconds and said, yeah. I reduced my work week. I worked less, I produced less, and I consumed less. And I now had more time. And I started getting involved in community. I wrote a book. Well, actually, I have to confess, I wrote most of the book while I was actually working. But I made films. My quality of life dramatically increased. That's the simple solution is you can reduce your work week, or you have to find some other way of counterbalancing the efficiencies that have been inserted into the economy. There are lots of ways that it can be done. More healthcare providers, more teachers, organic agriculture, because you have more people producing, your labor input increases, but your output stays the same. Any situation where your input, your labor input increases for a fixed amount of output, all has that same type of benefit of counterbalancing efficiencies. Personally, my favorite is working less. Thank you.
The next speaker is Dr. Bill Rees, professor at the University of British Columbia and co-inventor of the ecological footprint concept.
I'm a very practical person, and I subscribe to my previous colleague's notion of paying attention to the numbers. Show me the numbers. And I want to get to that in a moment, but I first want to underscore that despite the question that's been posed to this panel, sustainability is not fundamentally a technological question. It's really a question about human behavioral responses to the situation that we're in. The simple reality is, if you want to pick up an interesting book, it's called Factor 5 by Ernst von Weizsäcker. It shows that using off-the-shelf technologies, we could, in theory, produce exactly what we're producing on the planet today with about one-fifth the current energy and material throughput. So in theory, there's little question, it seems to me, that we could, and the question was posed, can new green technologies or business practices enable us to continue to grow while reducing our footprint? In theory, that's a real possibility. In practice, my prediction is that it will not happen. And it will not happen for reasons of human behavior, including an endemic problem that we have of being in a state of deep denial when it comes to serious challenges to our current way of life. We also have to keep a number of other things in mind, that the ecological crisis, the sustainability crisis, is in fact a product of technology. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, which was essentially a technological revolution, there was no ecological crisis. It's modern technology operating very often through the Jevons effect or the rebound effect that has enabled the human enterprise to expand to nearly 7 billion people with ever-increasing per capita demands on the planet. And it's that reality that has caused us to breach global ecological limits and has precipitated the ecological or sustainability crisis. Without technology, and particularly fossil fuel technologies, none of that would have been possible. I think it's also important to point out that this isn't just about reducing the carbon footprint. Every dimension of consumption is increasing. And as the human footprint increases, in fact, it's not decreasing anywhere, as the human footprint increases, it simply displaces other species and increasingly poorer people right off the planet. Let me make just a couple of very quick points. What we do is measure things. And the simple reality is that in every major country, especially the most efficient countries, per capita consumption or throughput overall of energy and material continues to increase. That is a product of technology. If you read anything about carbon dioxide emissions, you will have seen in the last couple of days that after a very minor downtick in the rate of increase last year, CO2 emissions are now increasing at a higher than ever rate once again this year, to the point where globally CO2 emissions are rising at about 2 parts per million per annum. The world is not reducing its ecological or its carbon footprint, which is only a fraction of the total ecological footprint. We have to recognize that what science tells us is that we need an 80% reduction in material and energy throughput on a per capita basis in rich countries to vacate the ecological space needed for justifiable growth in poor countries. We need, did you hear me? An 80% reduction in material and energy throughput on a per capita basis. That amounts to about a 50% reduction globally, but obviously a greater share of that falls on the already rich countries. So again, the requirement is a 50% global reduction, and all we're getting is a 3 or 4% annual increase in material throughput, including a global increase in our carbon emissions. It's simply not the case that these are going down on a global basis. The human ecological footprint continues to increase. Now, just a final point. In countries, we often hear that the more efficient countries and countries that are shifting to a high-income service economy reduce their footprints. For example, Switzerland is often cited as having a very low energy to GDP ratio. But that's a fallacy, or rather an artifact, of trade data and the way economists count things. If you actually look at material flows into Switzerland through trade, the footprint of the Swiss is as large as any other major European country, and they're not reducing their carbon footprint as indicated by actual consumption of goods and services. When we export our manufacturing industries to third world countries, the normal way of accounting for carbon is that the carbon produced in the production of goods and services for consumption in Canada are attributed to Chinese, for example. That becomes part of their apparent global footprint, but it's really ours. It's associated with our consumption. So when we correct our trade flows in this manner, it turns out that in most places that are in high-income service kinds of economies, the fallacy is revealed. They are not, in fact, reducing their eco-footprints. These eco-footprints continue to rise as a function of income when all flows of energy and material are taken into account. So we really haven't gotten serious about the sustainability challenge. A 50% reduction globally translated into an 80% reduction in the rich countries is not the same as the continuous global increase at the rate, just in terms of carbon dioxide alone, of 2 parts per million annually in our carbon dioxide emissions. Thank you.
We're listening to a conference on degrowth, the planned shrinking of the economy, and our demands on the natural world, recorded by Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Well, I guess we've come to some agreement that we've got a problem. So it seems to me the really important question is, what would an intelligent species do?
We're definitely not it.
in our present situation, because we're not acting intelligently. If we can honestly say that the technology exists, The means exists to reduce our eco-footprints while spreading, you know, the benefits of material growth to those who really deserve it, and we don't do that, then there's something clearly wrong with the way we function in the world. Part of it has to do with the way we apply the technology that we have. Most technological fixes today are oriented toward maintaining the status quo, to continuing the growth trajectory and the increases in income that we all, quote-unquote, enjoy annually. Now, the really important question is that a necessary thing to do? And I think we have to look very carefully at the consequences of material growth, both at the micro level, the individual level, and at the macro level. And when we do that, we find that in almost no advanced country is there any longer a correlation between personal or felt well-being and rising per capita income. So here we are, and again, I want you to keep asking yourself, are these the acts of an intelligent species? Maintaining our foot on the economic throttle by technological and other means to increase per capita consumption of goods and services, while it provides no personal individual benefit that's measurable, is a questionable activity, is it not? Moreover, if we look at most of the objective indicators of population well-being, they all show the same relationship. From your point of view, longevity rises with income, and then it flattens out and is level after that. It's called a diminishing returns curve. The curve begins to diminish at about $12,000 international per year, or about a quarter of Canadians' current per capita income, thereabouts. I forget the exact numbers. So the point is that in many rich countries, we've gone three or four or five times beyond the point where, in terms of the objective indicators, there's no further performance. Infant mortality is static. Longevity is static. It's actually falling in the United States, and so on. So again, on objective indicators, why are we so dedicated to maintaining the growth path if there's no further performance in terms of the quality of life measured in those means? So an intelligent species would ask a different question, and that is, what is the optimal scale of the economy that produces an adequate per capita income to max out in all of those factors that we consider to be important? After that, growth is futile. In fact, it's worse than futile, because if you count up all the damage costs of growth, and let's assume that my colleague is correct in that climate change is clearly underway today. Think of the damage costs of just what you've read about in the last months. They amount to billions and billions of dollars. We may well be at the point where the costs of growth, even in measurable dollar terms, exceed the benefits of growth in measurable dollar terms. So we are in a phase of what Herman Daly, another ecological economist, has called a phase of uneconomic growth. We're used to talking about economic growth, which is a good thing, but by definition, if growth is destroying more value than it's producing, then it's uneconomic and foolish to proceed. So again, the question becomes, what would an intelligent species do? Now, part of the problem is that some of our species, a little more intelligent than others, they've created a huge industry of counterintelligence, convincing people to vote against their own interests, for example, as we've seen in recent federal election in Canada and in the congressional elections in the United States recently. This is an unprecedented phenomenon where the capitalist class are spending hundreds of millions of dollars every year to spin scientific information to produce exactly the opposite face on reality that science proclaims. So we have a segment of society dedicated to socially constructing a scientifically false and, in fact, inverted picture of reality, and it's out of that picture that most ordinary people act, even though it's against their own interest. Now, there's another dimension of this we really have to keep in mind, and what I'm trying to underscore here is why this is not a technical problem, but a behavioral problem and a cultural problem. The distribution of the alleged costs and benefits is skewed. those people in a position of power to actually do anything about the economy, to actually do anything about the application of the technologies that could pull us off, to put in place the tax incentives required to bring in play the innovative alternative energies and so on, they have no incentive to do so. They represent vested interests in the existing coal industry, oil industry, and so on and so forth. And so the benefits go to them. They have no interest to act. The costs fall on the poor who aren't in a position to act, either politically or in terms of implementing policies. So we have a tremendous problem here in that the benefits and costs of the current paradigm fall disproportionately on the rich and poor, resulting in a form of social paralysis, which can only be overcome if there's essentially a popular revolution, which is being headed off by this propagandistic campaign to convince everybody of an untruth. I've gone on far longer than I should, but I've got 14 more pages I'd like to cover here. Thank you.
Why do we want to have economic growth at either the micro or the macro level?
Here is Conrad Schmidt.
In many ways, it's not optional. There's something I said a little earlier back. Technology, for the most part, makes us more efficient. Efficiency puts a mandate on the economy. Either grow, consume more, or face rising unemployment. Anytime you make something more efficient, any part of industry, it has to be counterbalanced by either rising unemployment or increased growth. A good example is the Great Depression. There were a lot of fantastic new inventions. Henry Ford comes up with the assembly line, the electrification of industry. They now can produce 20% more cars with the same amount of labor, 30%, 40%, 50%, and by 1916 it had doubled. You could produce more with less labor. That's what technology does. It makes us more efficient. Now, the consequence was that people were not consuming more. Our great-grandparents, they were kind of the frugal bunch. Well, I'm going to save this chest of drawers. I don't need to. I'll pass it on from one generation to the next. Even though they had invented mass production, they hadn't invented mass consumption. And that's why there was a Great Depression. Any situation, even today, we have the internet. It's making everybody so much more efficient. You now can have a store. You don't actually need employees. You just ship it by mail. Any efficiency puts that same mandate on the economy. And that's part of the problem, is that it is the impetus to growth. A lot of the things that we think are the solutions, be more efficient, just simply put that same mandate back into the economy. Thanks.
I'd like to take a run at that question. Growth is needed, but in the developing world. We have a situation today in which the richest 20% of the human family consume 76.5% of everything, and the poorest 20% live on 1.5% of total income. This incredible income disparity is immoral, unethical, and is unsustainable in and of itself. Therefore, it seems quite obvious that if there is to be growth in the world economy, it should occur in third world countries, which are still on that part of the curve where there's net benefits obtained from higher levels of consumption. But in order to create the ecological space on the planet for that growth to occur, rich countries must reduce their per capita consumption. Now, that sounds like a horrible thing, but ask Conrad. When you give up a day of work, your income may go down, but you've gained a whole day of spare time or free time to spend on, what's that word, self-actualization, with your family, engaged in political activities, which, by the way, is one of the reasons why they want you to work all the time, so you don't actually get serious about the politics of our country. What we really need in order to make this happen is a whole new array of social safety nets, so that people can downsize, move between jobs from the old to the new economy without fear of income loss. That means changing the tax system so that people who have excess income are sharing some of it with those who have insufficient income. You know, this whole issue of sustainability is a collective problem. You can't solve it alone. No country can solve it alone. Collective problems require collective solutions, policies put in place on the behalf of the whole of society by their governments. You cannot implement a rapid transit system. You cannot implement a carbon tax. But together, we can implement a carbon tax if our governments respond to a sufficient pressure to do so. And it will begin to have the restructuring effects on the economy that will lead toward the implementation of some of the technologies that will actually help us to move forward. So there's a whole array of things that could happen, but we're not doing them because of misinformation, because of denial, and our basic intransigence as human beings in our reluctance to change from what we take to be a fairly comfortable position in life.
Well, the idea behind degrowth is really quite simple. And that is, we don't need to redefine growth. We just need to stop doing what we're doing. Growth is not sustainable. There's lots of ways you can look at it. It is a bit of a divided movement in some aspects, but it's about bringing people together who want to challenge the idea of corporations busy funding all the research, who want to challenge a lot of the ideas about mainstream economics and start thinking about ways that we can be more socially sustainable.
Professor Bill Rees.
Well, I think there's two things that degrowth really brings into this picture. The first is to get people to stop, as one of us said, you know, thinking of these things as religions. It's not a question of whether you believe in growth or not, or you believe in sustainability or not. We have actual numbers to show the state of the world. We know that 75% of the world's fisheries are in trouble, and many stocks have collapsed. We know that climate change is a reality. We know that carbon dioxide emissions are 40% higher now than they were 150 years ago. Not emissions, but concentrations in the atmosphere. From ecological footprint analysis, we know that the current rate of consumption of biocapacity, the stuff the Earth's ecosystems produce every year, is about 50% higher than the annual rate of production. That means each year we use more than 50% more than the Earth is producing. Now you can ask, well, how can that be? And it's because we're drawing down the stocks of soil, fisheries, forests, biomass, and so on and so forth. We can continue to live by depleting assets for a certain period of time, but then you reach the point where you simply don't have enough biocapacity or ecosystems function left to sustain even current levels of consumption. So we're way beyond the point where we should be talking about whether growth is good, bad, or indifferent. It is valid, however, to talk about different kinds of growth. And what I'm talking about and the things we measure is material and energy throughput. It's the physical growth. You can have, in theory, income growth without an increase in material and energy throughput. This could happen if we applied some of the high-gain efficiency technologies which currently rest on the shelf because, for example, we're not willing to put in the tax incentive necessary for prices to tell the truth so that those technologies can compete with oil, gas, and some of the primitive technologies that are taking us down the tubes. So again, this is a very difficult set of questions. But if we think it through as intelligent human beings, we can see some light at the end of the tunnel. But as a culture, as a society, we are failing to do that. And as a result, most of the trends that have led us to this point of recognizing that we are unsustainable continue unabated. Now, again, I'll concede that in some isolated places you see real progress being made. But it's a marginal 1 or 2 or 3% of the total economic activity. It's wiped out with 1 year of growth.
That was my recording from the opening panel at the Degrowth Conference held at Simon Fraser University in downtown Vancouver on June 3, 2011. Just a word about our companion program, Earthbeat. That green hour of radio has been going out in the U.S. and Canada for over 6 years with early host Mike Tidwell and later Daphne Wysham. It's a super show with some of the best guests and breaking stories. Right now, Earthbeat is on hiatus while the production team reorganizes and refinances. Keep up to date with Earthbeat by going to the site at earthbeatradio.org. Find out all our past programs as free MP3 downloads at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex. Thanks for listening, and thank you for caring about our world.